the danger of nuclear war is real and must be stopped. Today's event is sponsored by the Schiller Institute, an international human rights organization founded in 1984 by Helga Sepp LaRouche, one of the speakers today. Helga has the distinction, along with former UN Weapons Inspector and U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter, as well as with Colonel Richard Black, who is also a distinguished Vietnam veteran and former state senator from Virginia, of having appeared on several hit lists that have been issued by the Ukrainian organization, the Center for Countering Disinformation, which has indirectly received funds from the United States. There are others in the room here today that share that same distinction. One of the questions that will be left with you today is, are American taxpayers funding foreign organizations that are directly threatening the lives, the livelihood, and the freedom of thought, as well as the freedom to travel of American citizens? Is the United States State Department engaged in activities that are violations of the rights of American citizens? I think we're all aware of the recent involuntary detour that Scott Ritter was forced to make from his appointment to speak at the recent St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which was attended by 19,000 other people from 136 countries. It was hardly a secret meeting. And it's hardly a secret that we have a problem in the United States. For example, this is hardly a secret meeting. It's hardly a secret that American society is at a crossroads, and today's topic defines it better than anything else. We are aware of the dangers that have occurred, particularly because of highly irresponsible actions taken in the military sphere, including the bombing of early warning systems in the territory of Russia. Scott Ritter, who people are aware, has gone out of his way in every way possible to call the attention to this, is here with us today. We're going to begin with him, followed by Colonel Black. So, Scott.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for the introduction. It's an honor and privilege to be here today to talk to you about a topic that sadly is being ignored. Pick up the morning newspaper, pick up the afternoon newspaper, pick up any newspaper, and I doubt you're going to see on the headline, America at imminent risk of nuclear Armageddon. But that should be the headline of every newspaper. That should be the lead story of every newscast. Not because the goal is to frighten people. I've had many people accuse me of fear-mongering, saying that it's irresponsible what you're doing promoting fear. I say it's irresponsible for the American public, for the American citizen, to allow the government that works for them to engage in policies that will lead to the termination of all human life on the planet Earth as we know it. And that's the end result here. We're talking about a number of things. Today we can talk about a failure of diplomacy. You know, I have said that we are at a period of time in our nation's history that is far more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And a lot of people take umbrage at that, especially people who didn't live during the Cuban Missile Crisis and have no concept of what the Cuban Missile Crisis was. But the Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962, people have said that's the closest the United States and the Soviet Union came to nuclear war. In a way, they're right. But let me talk about some differences at that time. While the Soviets were sending ships with missiles to Cuba, the danger was they were going to run into a blockade, lead to a direct military conflict that could expand into a nuclear conflict. While all that was happening, a man named John McCloy was speaking to a man named Valerian Zorin. Diplomacy was taking place. The United States were actively engaging with the Soviet counterparts to prevent the very war everybody was afraid of. The reason why there was no war is because there was diplomacy, because leaders were talking to leaders. if not directly, then indirectly, if not through official channels, then through the back channel. Diplomacy was alive and well. Today, ladies and gentlemen, right down the road in Wisconsin Avenue is an embassy, the Russian embassy. Seated in that embassy is a diplomat named Anatoly Antonov, one of the most distinguished American experts in the Russian Foreign Service, the lead arms control negotiator for the last remaining arms control treaty between Russia and the United States. He's been sitting there for several years, and his phone is not ringing. We are not calling him. We are not talking to him. There is no diplomacy today. And yet, our two countries are on a course, a collision course, that could very well lead to a nuclear conflict. And when I say nuclear conflict, let's be clear here. Now we're going to talk about doctrine. You know, there was a time when nuclear weapons existed for the purpose of deterring nuclear attack. Now, it's a sick thing, to, you know, this concept of deterrence, mutually assured destruction. It's sort of insanity encapsulated into, you know, a couple words. But that's the reality of it. The United States had nuclear weapons, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, and we had to make sure that nobody felt confident enough to use these weapons preemptively to gain some sort of strategic advantage. The end result was mutually assured destruction, nuclear deterrence. And this worked up until the end of the Soviet Union. It worked so well, I have to say, you know, one of my first adult jobs was as a Marine Corps officer implementing arms control treaties in the former Soviet Union, part of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, where we got rid of entire categories of nuclear weapons. The first time that we didn't just limit the growth, we actually reduced the arsenals. And this could have led to even greater cuts in the nuclear arsenals. But no, not for the United States. When the Soviet Union went away, we decided that we needed to maintain a nuclear advantage over the Soviets, and we corrupted the concept of arms control. We withdrew from arms control treaties like the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which gave mutually assured destruction its teeth. See, without ballistic missile defense, the missiles will hit their target, which means that if you go to war, your missiles will hit the target they're aimed at, the missiles aimed at you will hit the target. Under George W. Bush, we decided we didn't want any missiles to hit America. Ostensibly a rational thought, except at the same time we were seeking to gain nuclear supremacy over the Russians so that our missiles would hit Russia. This creates an imbalance. And after 9/11, we went further. We saw a transition of nuclear deterrence doctrine into nuclear war fighting doctrine, where we embraced a doctrine that said that we could use nuclear weapons preemptively against a non-nuclear threat. Our current president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, Joe Biden, campaigned on a promise to return America to the sanity of sole use doctrine, meaning the sole purpose of America's nuclear arsenal would be to deter others from attacking us. He didn't do it. Why? I attended a reunion of intermediate nuclear forces, inspectors, negotiators a couple years ago, and we asked that question to a senior Biden administration arms control official. The answer, the interagency isn't ready for this yet. Now, I live in a nation that is ostensibly the greatest democracy in the world. I know that I go to vote. I know I look at the names on the ballot. I never saw interagency on the ballot. I don't know what the hell they're talking about when it comes to democracy. The president is the commander-in-chief. He is the executive. If he wants a policy direction, he directs it to happen. And the interagency needs to salute smartly and seek to implement it. But we're being told that the interagency isn't ready. That means the establishment isn't ready. That means the establishment seeks something else. And that, of course, is American nuclear supremacy. We live in a world where other nations will no longer tolerate this. Russia is one of them. And Russia today is a nation that is at the pointy end of the American nuclear spear. They're seeing the United States promulgate policies that have American military capabilities thrust up to the very borders of Russia, indeed crossing over into the borders of Russia, threatening Russia's strategic nuclear enterprise, early warning radars, command and control facilities, even nuclear weapons depots and nuclear launch systems. We have facilitated, we being the United States, an attack against Ingalls Air Base where Russian strategic nuclear bombers are stationed. Under Russian doctrine, this alone justifies a nuclear response. We've been tickling the Russian nuclear bear for a long time, and only through the patience and wisdom of the Russian leadership have we avoided a nuclear war. As an American, I take umbrage at that. I don't want to be at the mercy of any foreign leader. I would rather that the American leadership take a rational step towards deconfliction, that I be at the mercy of a government that I get to hold accountable at the polls, government of the people, by the people, for the people, a constitution that begins with "we the people of the United States of America." And that's the final thought I want to put out there. We have a duty and responsibility as citizens to wake up and recognize the threats that face us collectively as a nation, as a people. And the greatest threat to the continued survival of the United States of America today is American nuclear policy, American nuclear weapons. These weapons do not protect us, ladies and gentlemen. These weapons are literally a loaded gun at our head with an insane man's finger on the trigger. We need to come together. We need to stop this. We have an election in November, and let us all do our job as citizens and vote for somebody who places the survival of America above all else, which means they place nuclear nonproliferation, nuclear disarmament, and arms control above all else. Thank you very much.
Before you say something, sir, I want to just, because I didn't fully correctly introduce him. Colonel Richard Black is a combat veteran who has seen the face of war. He always talks about how he shed a bucket of blood for his country. He talks about seeing people killed next to him as a pilot. He's the former head of the U.S. Army's Criminal Law Division of the Pentagon, former Virginia State Senator. But most importantly, as Scott was just referencing, and I decided I should say something, he has seen the face of war, and he intends to stop it. Colonel Black.
Thank you much for the kind introduction. Yes, I'm Senator Dick Black, and the purpose of our press conference today is to alert the world to the great risk of nuclear accident occurring. We're growing very close to that. It's important to understand the nature of American military doctrine regarding nuclear weapons. Our nuclear doctrine grants the President of the United States plenary authority, unfettered authority, to launch a nuclear strike for any reason or for no reason at all. It is an offensive doctrine. It is not a defensive doctrine. It is a doctrine that allows the President to wake up and decide that he is going to carry out a nuclear Pearl Harbor against an enemy of his choice. Now, obviously, there are political considerations, but if you're talking about a nuclear war, you're talking about a situation where there is going to be such vast destruction that political considerations are going to dim into the background. There was a comment made just this last Friday by a fellow, Pranay Badi, who is with the National Security Council. He's the senior arms control official. And he was commenting on why more nuclear weapons might be required. Now, both the United States and Russia have over 5,000 nuclear weapons currently. China has 600. Now, here's something that Mr. Vadi said as a representative from the White House. National Security Council is in the White House. He said, quote, "We need to be fully prepared to execute if the president makes that decision." Now, what does he mean by execute? He means we need to be prepared to launch a nuclear strike if the president decides we're going to do so. This is a great deal different from Russian or Chinese doctrine. The Russian document doctrine is it's based on the defensive use of nuclear weapons. They can use them if they are imminently about to be attacked, if they are attacked, or if the cohesion of Russia as a nation is about to be destroyed by the attack of an enemy. So it should greatly distress us and concern us that we have a White House official saying we need to be prepared to execute if the president makes that decision. We should not, in a responsible government, we should never be talking about the president ordering a nuclear strike. Now, to go back with the war in Ukraine, which has gotten us to this point, Ukraine was never a vital United States interest. The war has been fought principally over the idea of whether Ukraine would be integrated into NATO, which would then allow nuclear missiles to be stationed right up to the Russian border. In other words, Russia would be in a posture where they could be attacked suddenly, unexpectedly, and have absolutely no time to respond. That really is the essence of what you get to with this enormous, deadly war in Ukraine. Now, the war is being fought at the doorstep of a giant nuclear superpower. You go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I lived through that. I lived in Miami, and I was in Havana, Cuba, before the revolution. I was there after the revolution. I watched the whole thing unfold, and I literally discovered a vast military convoy that was moved secretly through the city of Miami at night in preparation to invade Cuba. Now, they never did, but it sure made my eyes bulge out while I was driving up Route 27 and this endless convoy came the other way. But at that time, there was such a dramatic difference because Russia was a weak nuclear power. It was not as a nuclear force, it was not a very big nuclear force. Today, it actually has more nuclear weapons than the United States. Both have roughly 5,000. They have a little more. But in any event, where we have gotten to, this war, this terrible war, the biggest war in Europe since the Second World War, is being fought on the doorstep of Russia. And the Russians entered the war in February of 22. 4 days after they crossed the border, negotiations with Ukraine began, peace negotiations. After 4 days, after 2 months, a peace agreement had been pretty well hammered out to the point where the first deputy foreign minister of Ukraine announced that they were virtually on the edge of an agreement. And it was at that point that the prime minister of Ukraine, or the Boris Johnson, was sent to basically tell them, knock off these peace talks, get back to the important work of fighting. When the peace agreement was was about to be finalized, there were very few casualties, relatively. There was very little property destruction. And the parties both were fairly pleased with the peace agreement. It was something they both could live with. So all of this vast sea of bloodshed that has followed has been largely unnecessary. Now, what's happened is that Ukraine is running out of manpower. They're much smaller in population than Russia, and the casualties have worn them down. And as they have become weaker and weaker in terms of manpower, you have the United States and NATO becoming increasingly restless and anxious to sort of pull this thing off, to bring them to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. We've seen them with the United States and working together with Ukraine and NATO. They sank the flagship of the Russian fleet, the cruiser Moskva. In a very, very dramatic action, the United States orchestrated the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, which has permanently damaged the European economy, and particularly the economy of Germany, which was thrown into a recession because of the destruction of Nord Stream. More recently, we've had Emmanuel Macron, the French president, and he has been the lead man in a trial balloon to see whether Western countries could be incentivized to go ahead and send their own troops as trainers, just like in Vietnam, trainers, into Ukraine, which inevitably would lead to their engagement in battle. Everybody understands that. All of this has built up to the point where we just had the European Union elections, and the elections were a devastating loss for the powers that be in NATO. Tremendous conservative victory, and I think, among other things, it has reflected the fact that Europeans are sick and tired of war. They never wanted this war. It was imposed on them, and they would like to be away from it. But nonetheless, we continue, as has been mentioned, with the attacks to blind the radars that defend Moscow from an unprovoked attack by missiles coming in. We have helped Ukraine to launch the attacks on the Engels Air Base, where they have their nuclear bombers stationed. And it goes on and on. Most recently, we're now talking about making our nuclear doctrine even more aggressive. Now, I don't honestly know. If I had the assignment, how do you make the nuclear doctrine of the United States more aggressive than giving the president carte blanche authority to attack anybody at any time? I would have to ask a lot of questions if someone assigned me that task. But in any event, as we get closer to the election, as things become more desperate on the Ukrainian front lines, we have an anxious White House that is willing to attempt more and more reckless actions, and there's a very high risk that this nuclear gambit that's underway right now may not succeed, and that an accident could occur, and we won't be holding another press conference to announce the results of it when that's finished. So in any event, we'll continue, but thank you, and thank you, Scott, for your comments.
Our next speaker, coming to us from Germany, is the author of 10 Principles of a New International Security and Development Architecture. She issued these 10 principles on November 22nd, 2022, at a conference which was called On Stopping the Danger of Thermonuclear War Then. The first of those points stated that the new international security and development architecture must be a partnership of perfectly sovereign nation states, which is based on the 5 principles of peaceful coexistence in the UN Charter. The second principle was the absolute priority must be to alleviate poverty in every nation on the planet, which is easily possible if the existing technologies are being used for the benefit of the common good. Helga Sepp LaRouche was also the inspiration for the creation of an organization called the International Peace Coalition, which has held 53 consecutive meetings and will be holding its 54th meeting this coming Friday. It's always my honor to introduce her. Welcome, Helga.
Thank you, Dennis. Well, right now we have the second maneuver rehearsing the deployment of tactical nuclear weapons. This is not a routine maneuver, but explicitly in response to Western provocations, such as Macron's announcement of sending troops to Ukraine, Cameron's permission that Ukrainians can use all weapons for strikes into Russian territory, and naturally the attack on the early radar warning system. So this is now happening. Also today, actually, a Russian flotilla, or not a flotilla, of ships has arrived in Cuba, a frigate and a nuclear submarine and two other ships. And there is no question that we are right now at a reversed Cuban missile crisis, except it is, for the reasons in part already mentioned, much more dangerous than the first nuclear, the first Cuban missile crisis. Now, the worst problem is that the Western establishments have talked themselves into the belief that whatever Russia is doing is just bluffing. And, you know, this is while, you know, the population is not being told that what is happening from the side of NATO is actually a nuclear chicken game, which is, you know, taking the limits further and further and further, crossing red lines all the time. And we are indeed at the verge of a potential catastrophe. Now, I want to reference a solution which was mentioned by Dennis. We absolutely have to change the entire outlook. We have to go to a new paradigm. And the most obvious reference point is the Peace of Westphalia, which ended 150 years of religious warfare in Europe. And it occurred because the participants of the war realized that if they would continue, there would be absolutely nobody left to survive to enjoy the victory. Because at that point, already one third of all of villages, people, animals were all destroyed, and the continuation would have destroyed everybody else. So now, in the times of nuclear weapons, it is also clear that if it ever would come to a nuclear weapon, a nuclear war, there would be absolutely nobody left to survive, to enjoy the victory. Now, there is a debate, you know, that this is not going to be fatal, that you can have a tactical nuclear war. But I think people should study the writings of Ted Postol, who very clearly developed the idea, what is the fundamental difference between a conventional war and a nuclear war? And the likelihood that it would end up with a total global war where all nuclear weapons will be used, followed by probably 10 years of a nuclear winter where all life on the planet would be extinct, so that not even a historian would be left to investigate the reasons how this happened, is very likely. Therefore, we have to draw the lesson of the Peace of Westphalia. We should have an immediate new security and development architecture which takes into account the interest of every single country on the planet. Because that's the lesson from the Peace of Westphalia, that if you do not take into account the interest of the other, and that means all others, peace is not possible. Whenever that principle was applied, it led to peace. When it was not applied, like in the Versailles Treaty, it was just a stepping stone to the next war, which in that case was World War II. So the Peace of Westphalia as a model for such a conference, which I volunteered to write 10 principles to give people an idea what such a new security and development architecture must absolutely take into account. I would ask people to get these 10 principles and look at them. And I think it is eminently possible. Now, what would be the institution which could implement such an idea? Well, if nothing else helps, it has to be put to the UN General Assembly because it concerns all people on the planet if we are going to live or die. The Chinese government has already made several proposals. Xi Jinping proposed the Global Security Initiative, the Global Development Initiative, and the Global Civilizational Initiative, which has exactly such an approach of an all-inclusive idea that all nations must be a part of it. Also, the recent Brazilian-Chinese proposal for a Ukraine peace conference is all-inclusive, unlike the Swiss Bogenstock conference, which is doomed to fail simply because it does not invite Russia to be a participant, and it is based on a premise which cannot lead to a result in any case. So I think we are at a point, you know, where the peoples of the world are called to bring in their voice, because already in the Bandung conference in 1955, President Sukarno and Nehru said that if it ever comes to a global war, maybe the countries of the global south will die a few weeks later, but they will die anyhow. And that is why the issue of war and peace is not a matter of just NATO or some military industrial complex or whatever. It is a question of every citizen on the world, which by the very nature of a global war must act as a world citizen. And therefore, I think we need to have a public debate about such an idea, because if we continue with the geopolitical confrontation, it is just a question of time when it will be too late. But we are the intelligent species, we are the creative species, and therefore, you know, we should have confidence that we can find a solution to such an absolutely existential problem like the mortal threat to our existence.
We're beginning a transition in our discussion now, and as we begin to go to various matters, we want to first ask that Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, speak to us. Ray McGovern, as some people know, was hoping to be with us today. He was unable to do so because of medical circumstances. Larry is currently a senior fellow at what's called the Eisenhower Media Network, which is a group of former military, intelligence, and civilian national security officials who are concerned to counter Washington's establishment narrative on most national security issues of the day. Some of us remember, not fondly, and Larry has no problem with this, 21 years ago when he was sitting next to Colin Powell, when Colin Powell did his thing at the United Nations, and Larry has been very, very clear about the nature of that disaster. He's been very clear about his role. He's been very clear about reversing that role. And why this is important is that something like that kind of Damascus Road is what we're going to need coming from various members of the American military and intelligence very rapidly if we're going to survive what we're now in. So if it's my first honor. This is the first time I've done this, to welcome Larry. And Larry, please, you have the floor. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. And thank you for having me here. And thank Ray for letting me fill in for him. I'm going to speak very briefly, but I hope the points I make will resonate along with those that Scott gave and the others, because they're all very important points. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to sit down with a great man, a patriot, a hero of this country. And the question we were dealing with was posed by him. And this was Dan Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers fame. And Dan said, the question is, are we closer today than we were since August 29th, 1949, when the Soviets exploded their first atomic bomb and there was competition, nuclear competition? And before I could answer, he said, we are. Absolutely, we are closer than we have ever been before. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is right. The hand is moving so close to midnight that you can hardly decipher the clock. We are that close to nuclear conflict. This is Stan Ellsberg, who was one of the premier, if not the premier, nuclear planner for RAND and then for the Pentagon at the time when he was working for the United States government. This is the man also who drove a Jeep through the wire out of Nevada to get to Ground Zero to make sure that Ronald Reagan couldn't conduct that last nuclear test. And he was successful. Drove a Jeep to Ground Zero so they couldn't shoot. A very brave man, a hero. And he thought we were at that point that we had never been at before, a few seconds from nuclear war. And we talked about the reasons. And the first reason Scott has already talked about, but I want to reiterate it because it's so important, because it's all our fault. It is the empire's fault. It is the United States of America's fault. We have abrogated every treaty regime pertinent to nuclear weapons. We did it. We even caused the last and ultimate one, New START, to not be looked on favorably for renewal by Moscow because of our actions in Ukraine. So we have abrogated every single protective treaty environment that we painstakingly crafted over the many years of the Cold War. Nuclear weapons are free to roam. The second point is we now have 9 countries who are nuclear weapon states, and I include Israel, of course, in there. One of the most dangerous nuclear weapon states, in my view. We have 2 or 3 aspirants. Frankly, I think the Saudis have contracted with the Pakistanis to buy 30 or 40 warheads if Iran develops one. So we could have 2 nuclear weapon states within a moment or two if Iran suddenly decided to take the enriched uranium they have now, which the IAEA has even said is enough for 3 bombs. And pretty shortly, if they made that decision. So we have a proliferation of nuclear weapon states and no treaty regimes whatsoever. The third point, and this is as important as the first two, and I've discovered this in traveling all across America and speaking on university campuses, to rotaries, to all manner of different organizations in all 50 states, the American people have forgotten. The American people do not understand what it was to build a bomb shelter in your backyard and stock it with food and water. I used to hand out a pamphlet from the United States government signed by Lyndon Baines Johnson that told you with photographs and pictures and other paraphernalia in the pamphlet how to build a bomb shelter in your backyard. I used to go in the basement of my school when I was a youngster and sit there with my head in my lap as the teacher instructed us how to perform, because we were doing a nuclear drill. We don't have any idea in this nation anymore of what nuclear weapons can do. And then the last, we had a principle during the Cold War. It was absolutely fundamental to our philosophy about nuclear weapons. And it was pretty fundamental with the other nuclear weapon-owning states in the world as well, including Russia, the Soviet Union at that time. No weapon-owning state would ever go directly to war with another weapon-owning state. Think about that for a moment. That's a pretty darn good principle. The only time that's been violated is with India and Pakistan. And in both cases, we rushed off to Delhi and Islamabad as fast as we could get there, and sat down, and in 2002, I know personally about this, with General Musharraf and with the diplomats in New Delhi, and we told them, stop now, stop now, and gave them no choice, really. We even sort of rendered a threat. No two nuclear weapon-owning states should go to war with one another. Where are we in Ukraine? Where are we in Ukraine? We are a hair's breadth from violating that principle. A hair's breadth. And we've got leaders like Macron, who thinks he's a latter-day Charles de Gaulle, who wants to make that threat real, want to actually introduce NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine. So we are at a very dangerous period, and if Dan were still alive, Dan would be apoplectic at this point. I guarantee you he would. He spent his life trying to prevent this moment from coming, and it looks as if it's more imminent than it has ever been since August the 29th, 1949. And the American people, by and large, are utterly ignorant as to this fact. Thanks.
Okay, I first want to just ask if anyone of the speakers has anything that they would like to either say or respond to anything that has been heard. So first I'll just ask Scott, anything at this point? Okay. Colonel Black?
I think I'm good.
You're good, fine. Helga, if you're hearing me?
Fine.
You okay? All right. So let's do the following. How we'll proceed, we have people who are present in the room, and then we all have people who are on internet. So what I want to do is to ask for the first two questions or comments to come from the room here, and then the next two will come from internet. Please raise your hands to get in line in the queue for the on the virtual side so we can list the names and know who you're with. So we're going to start here in the room. We're getting a microphone, which will be available. All right, in the back. And please identify yourself when you speak.
I'm Ken Meyercord. If the leaders of every nuclear power knew that they were going to die if they initiate a nuclear attack, do you think that would deter them from doing so?
And to whom are you directing that?
Anybody.
Well, I'm not sure whether it would or not. But we do know that, we do know that the leadership of the United States has ways that they will go underground. They will not be killed by the first strike. My guess is there are probably a number of the global elite who will be protected. So whether that makes a difference, I don't know. It's almost as though, you know, we don't have a central organizing intellect to our war policy. We've got all the various countries of NATO. We have all these various departments of the government. And it's as though there's always somebody in every department who wants to have the latest little foot forward. And so there's somebody who says, why don't we give them M1 tanks? Well, why don't we give them HIMARS missiles? Why don't we do the ATACMs, even though they can reach way out into Russia with those? How about F-16 jets? How about, you know, shouldn't we be talking about tactical nuclear bombs? And it's as though we're just sort of meandering. Early in the war, I'm sure Scott will recall, he may have been an Italian general, but there was someone who made the comment that it seems as though we're sleepwalking into World War III. And that got my attention. It's not as though there's some central scheme and plan, but it's sort of this unfolding amorphous thing. And fortunately, I think on the other side, there is a central organizing intellect. There is a central disciplining individual. I think President Putin has firm control of the direction and the limits. And while they love to try to get people to start calling him Mad Vlad, the West has essentially banked its entire existence on his rationality and the fact that he will not do something that is rash and unpredictable.
I support everything Colonel Black just said, not just because he outranks me, but because he's right. I'm going to build upon what Colonel Wilkerson said. You know, the question was, do you think the leaders understand that if we go to nuclear war, they're going to die? I will say today that in the West, there's not a single leader who understands what nuclear war is. And because you don't understand what nuclear war is, you don't understand the consequences thereof. You know, in the Cold War, we had a plan. It was the Single Integrated Operations Plan. It was the nuclear plan. And when John F. Kennedy was first briefed on it, when he became president, he got sick to his stomach and turned to his advisor and said, "We call ourselves a human race." And he chastised the Pentagon. He said, "You can't ask me to push a button and destroy the world. You have to give me options." So the Pentagon gave him options, which was no matter what he did, he pushed a button and it ended the world. Lyndon Johnson was faced with the same insanity. Every American president during the Cold War understood the consequences of his actions, that if we initiated a nuclear strike, we would all die. He would die. There's no surviving this at all. Then the Cold War ended, and we went into this period where people forgot what nuclear war was. In fact, it was a good thing. I like it that we forgot what nuclear was, because it meant that we were doing things like detargeting our missiles so that the missiles in their silos weren't on a hair trigger to be fired off. They had taken the target out of the missiles. In order to use these missiles, you had to make a deliberate decision to retarget them, to rebuild the plan. And this created time for sanity to sink in. And then George W. Bush came along and decided that America's nuclear arsenal had to be a usable nuclear arsenal. But we operated under the notion that we were the supreme nuclear power and that we could intimidate anybody into submission, that nobody had the guts to stand up to us, especially the Russians or the Chinese, because we made it clear that they would be destroyed, that they would die, and we operated under the premise that we wouldn't die. And so it all became a big game of bluff, of bluster, of bullying. Well, the Russians haven't put up with that, neither have the Chinese. Today, Russia has the superior nuclear power. It's the superior nuclear power in the world with a modernized nuclear force that can destroy every target in the United States, any place in the world that it wants to. Fortunately, it's tied to a doctrine that has some sort of sanity built into it. You talked about, Colonel Black, somebody saying we need to, you know, become more aggressive with our nuclear doctrine. What it means is we need to become more aggressive with our bluff. We see, somebody might not be afraid of America if they know all we have is Minuteman III or Tridents with city-killing capability. But my God, if we make the W-76-2 low-yield nuclear weapon and we put it on a Trident missile in a Ohio-class submarine, we now have the capability to launch a small nuclear war. And then we can escalate to de-escalate. How do we prove to the Russians that we can beat them if they don't think we're going to fire our missile? By firing a missile with a nuclear warhead that just goes boom instead of boom. And we think that the Russians would go, "Oh, gosh, thanks for nuking us. We're done." But what we honestly believe is that now the Russians think that because we have this usable nuclear weapon, that we may in fact use it. So to prevent us from using it, Russia will alter its patterns of behavior. But Russia won't alter its patterns of behavior when it comes to issues of existential survival. The United States, we talk about backing ourselves into a corner. In this case, the United States is advancing ourselves into a corner of no return. We are creating a nuclear doctrine backed by capacity, backed by doctrine, backed by aggressive leadership that doesn't understand the consequences of their actions. We will go to nuclear war and we will meet our nuclear demise not because somebody intended for this to happen, but because it was an accident. They said they will never call our bluff. They will never react in a way because, oh, they just nuked us. It's all over. And that's the future of this world, ladies and gentlemen, unless we find a way to reverse course. And the first thing, and I agree with Colonel Wilkerson on this so much, sir, we have to find a way to make the American people afraid again. And that's a horrible thing to say. But if the American people don't do what you and I did when I was a kid, I grew up in Germany next to a nuclear weapons storage facility. And when my dad went into the bunker, which meant that we might be going to war, that meant the world was going to end. And I grew up as a child fearful. I would go to school in the morning not knowing whether or not I would come home at night or there would be a world. That's no childhood for anybody. But it made me scared to death of nuclear weapons, which made the joy I felt when I participated in getting rid of nuclear weapons as a weapons inspector that much more. We need to recapture that joy, Colonel, but we have to do it by making Americans afraid again.
Let me, two things. I'm going to ask whether, Helgut, would you have anything to say on this question, or do we pass?
We pass.
Okay. And Colonel Wilkerson?
Well, I just say that I agree with Scott. I think we do need to scare people again. And I would reiterate the euphoria that existed just after the end of the Cold War when we were in Russia destroying warheads. We were destroying them so fast that the lawyers got involved and stopped us on liability issues. But we were actually destroying warheads. We talked about us being around 5,000, 6,000 or so today. We had 30,000 each then. We destroyed all those warheads. That in and of itself shows what's possible. We were planning on the joint staff. This is no joke. We were planning to go down to somewhere around 1,200 warheads, total warheads of all types. We thought about and had a study from, of all places, the U.S. Air Force that said we could go down to 600. All we had to do was talk our other antagonists in the world, and they didn't look like much antagonists at that time, into doing the same thing. And maybe even we could make the non-proliferation treaty have some real robust meaning. Those were good days. How did we lose them? We polluted them.
All right. We're going to go back to here. We'll go here first.
Okay.
And let me also say, while we're going to this other question, the first question was perfect in length because of the answers that you're going to get. So we just like to ask that when people speak, please be concise and think clearly about what it is. And if you have a particular person you want to have answer, please indicate that as well.
Okay. I'm Diane Sayre. I happen to be also an independent candidate for U.S. Senate in New York. And this question of how we wake up the American people looms large. I would like to particularly ask Helga her thoughts on the relationship between the looming blowout of the transatlantic financial system and the war drive. I think we clearly see the elections are a factor in keeping up a delusion of some kind of military victory against Russia. But that, what happened when the Berlin Wall came down, because really the only thing I can think of is there has to be some kind of revolution in the West. And the last thing that I can think about is the shift that was huge. I think it's not much on people's minds. It was a missed opportunity. Are there parallels in this situation? One thing that comes to mind is the movement on the campuses against the genocide in Gaza. But I'd really like your thoughts on how we break this and the connection between the financial situation and the war drive.
Well, retrospectively, the end of the Soviet Union and the German unification was a historical chance. You know, in German you call it Sternstunde der Menschheit, a star hour of humanity, because, you know, there was the possibility to have a peace order for the 21st century. At that time, even some years before, the Soviet Union was not regarded as a threat anymore. The hope of Gorbachev and even Putin later until 2001 was that Russia could maybe join NATO, which he mentioned to Clinton when Clinton visited Moscow in 2001. And we proposed at that time the Eurasian land bridge as the economic basis for such a peace order. Now, that chance was sorely missed. It's one of the great tragedies at all. And that we are today at the verge of World War III is that the neocons in Great Britain and in the United States decided to use the unipolar world conception, running the world as an empire based on the Anglo-American special relationship, and declare the end of history, Fukuyama, as meaning that everybody would adopt the neoliberal model of Western democracy. And what followed was decades of NATO expansion to the East, color revolution, regime change, interventionist wars. And this has all brought us to the point where we are today. It has caused a tremendous backlash, a blowback of incredible proportions. And almost everything what is happening in the world is the result of these wrong policies by the West from that moment on. And the fact that we have now the BRICS countries, becoming probably the BRICS plus 50, maybe not this year, but soon, the fact that the Global South is deciding to form their own economic system is, regarded as a big threat to the hegemon. But what I'm suggesting is a completely different approach. None of these countries, not China, not Russia, not Brazil, not India, not South Africa, nor any of the new Global South countries which are forming this new economic alliance, is an enemy of the United States or Europe. If the United States and Europe would say, okay, we stop geopolitics and we go for a new system where we cooperate instead of confrontation, the problems of the world are so massive. We have world hunger. We have the migration problem. We have, unbelievable misery of so many people. And if all the nations would decide to cooperate to uplift the human species, it could be done, maybe not as Trump was saying, in a day, but it could be done in a very, very quick period of time. And I personally think it's the only hope. And, the idea of a new security and development architecture is not an illusion. I think it's the only realistic approach. And it includes emphatically a reorganization of the bankrupt financial system. Because as you correctly say, Diane, the real motor of the war drive is the fact that the transatlantic neoliberal system is hopelessly bankrupt. We are sitting on a debt of 2 quadrillion outstanding derivatives. There is no way how this can be remedied under normal conditions. The central banks are always moving between quantitative easing, quantitative tightening, because there is no way out of it. The system could blow out at any moment as we are sitting here. And the only orderly approach is to do exactly what Franklin D. Roosevelt did in 1933, banking separation, exactly like the Glass-Steagall Act prescribed. And, then basically move to have a new credit system which provides credit for development. This is why we have said that the new name for peace is development. And, one very important aspect of this new security and development architecture I mentioned is our proposal how to remedy the crisis with Gaza, Israel, Southwest Asia. We have actualized an old proposal of my late husband, Linda LaRouche, the OASIS plan, which is the idea to have massive development of new fresh water through desalinization of ocean water, through the use of peaceful nuclear energy, and have a massive economic development of all of Southwest Asia, because that's the only way how you can overcome this conflict. So there are constructive proposals which all could go into this new development and security architecture. And I think, I really urge people to think about it. I do not think that anything short of that will solve the problem.
Okay, I have a list of 4 people so far on the YouTube. It's probably larger since I was standing here. I'm going to announce the first 2, and then we'll return to the live audience here. So it's Steve Starr is the first person, and then Antonio Valdez from El Mercurio. So I think we have audio on them only. So can we bring Steve up?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Stephen Starr. I'm a professor at the University of Missouri. I teach a class here on nuclear weapons, and I also recently published a book on nuclear high-altitude electromagnetic pulse. My question is for Colonel Wilkerson and Scott Ritter. As was mentioned, three of Russia's 10 nuclear early warning system radar sites were recently attacked by Ukrainian drones. Considering that these Russian radars are specifically designed to observe incoming nuclear-armed U.S. ICBMs and could not play any role in the Ukraine war, what do you think was the purpose of these attacks, and did the U.S. provide the targeting data for the drones that were used in the attacks?
Colonel, you outrank me.
The answer to your questions, I think, and this is somewhat speculation, but it's informed speculation, is yes. We knew all about it. We even provided targeting data. And why we did it, I have to answer by saying we're insane. They do not have, the Russians do not have the kind of sophisticated array of warning that we have in space. So this is very important to them. This is like our old distant early warning line, which never worked, but theirs works. And it has absolutely no capability of surveilling the battlefield in Ukraine. So what was the purpose of hitting it? I suspect the purpose of hitting it was something akin to the same purpose of taking out Nord Stream 2. It's absurd. It's insane. But this is the kind of thing we do today.
I would back up the colonel by noting that, you know.
Microphone.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm a Marine, so I'm used to projecting my voice without microphones. So, you know, I'll use Air Force technology. But the United States and NATO employ what we call today intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets over Ukraine and around Ukraine. These drone attacks, I don't believe, could have penetrated Russian air defenses without access to real-time intelligence about where these air defenses are deployed, what the radar envelopes are, what the terrain features are, how you can use terrain masking, timing of attack, the specific route of attack. It's a very sophisticated plot that is beyond the capability of Ukraine to do on its own volition. So I agree with the colonel that the United States was directly involved in the targeting of this. Now the question is, why would the United States do this? And I come back to one of my built-in assumptions is that we think the Russians are bluffing. We believe that if we can put enough pressure on Russia, that we will cause the Russians to quickly seek the negotiating table to bring an end to this conflict. A lot of what we have been doing against the Russians, using the Ukrainians as proxies, is tied to something that's scheduled to take place I think next week, the Swiss, peace conference. But the purpose of the Swiss peace conference isn't to seek peace. It's to create a global coalition who can put political pressure on Russia. And so there's a sequencing of trying to build this global coalition to put pressure on Russia and putting Russia in a state where it will respond to that pressure. And so these attacks that have been made against Russia's critical infrastructure, attacks made against Russian civilian targets, are all designed to wear down the resolve of the Russian government so they would respond to this pressure. This is lunacy in the extreme. Russia has a nuclear posture which clearly states that when its critical nuclear infrastructure is placed under threat, to include nuclear threat or conventional threat, that this warrants a threat of existential nature that can legitimately give Russia the green light to use their nuclear weapons in response. Russians aren't bluffing. They don't bluff. The Russians are highly responsible. They have a very mature posture and very mature leadership. Vladimir Putin's been in power for 25 years. You get to know the lay of the land during that time. He is comfortable with where Russia is. He is comfortable with who Russia is. And he is comfortable with Russia's place in the world. He is not going to throw away a quarter of a century's work on a whim, on an urge, on miscalculation. But at the end of the day, when he is confronted with an existential threat, he will respond in accordance with Russian doctrine. And that means nuclear weapons. This is a gross miscalculation on the part of the Ukrainians, on the part of the United States, and on the part of all the allies that we have tried to bring together to put this pressure on Russia. We don't understand Russia, which is why I believe the best thing we can do as Americans is to begin talking to the Russians, begin listening to the Russians, begin learning about the Russians so that we better understand who they are, what they want, and we can make responsible policies based upon that.
Colonel Wilkerson, any thoughts?
I'm told, and I believe it, that Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan cannot talk to Sergei Lavrov. They cannot pick up the telephone and talk to one of the most accomplished diplomats on the face of the earth, Sergei Lavrov. That's absurd. What do you do diplomacy for? Whom do you talk to most urgently with diplomacy? Your enemies, not your friends. Talk to your friends on a cell phone anytime you want to. You talk to your enemies or your would-be enemies or your pretend enemies, but you definitely don't forbid your top diplomat from talking to the top diplomat of the country you're most embroiled with and most dangerously embroiled with.
Hmm. Colonel Black, did you have something you wanted to?
No, I thought I would just add the fact that when it comes to the drone attacks on the radar sites that defend Moscow, this was a coordinated thing. This was not simply somebody from Ukraine, maybe with some permission from some Americans to go ahead and do this, but it was orchestrated because you had the attack on the early warning system. You had the attack on the nuclear bombers. You had the integration and the adjustment of the F-16 jets to make them nuclear capable and nuclear ready. All of these things coming together. Maybe it was an effort to bluff, to raise the stakes on the Russians, or maybe it was simply the way that the Pentagon does to make sure that if they anticipate that the commander-in-chief might take a certain action, that they put things in place to make sure that they're ready for it. In either event, it is a very dangerous thing because it just ratchets up. If you're bluffing, there's always a chance that the other person calls your bluff. And if he calls the bluff, it is Russia's general position that they don't fight a limited nuclear war. Their idea is that nuclear war is an all-out war. We have this idea, well, maybe you can tinker around. Maybe you can have a little nuclear war, and that'll work out, and everybody will back down. Sometimes people don't back down. And to gamble the existence of humanity on whether somebody will back down, it's one thing if you got 50 bucks on a card table in a poker game, but you're actually putting all of humanity on the table. We're the chips, and we've got reckless people gambling our lives with us.
Okay. Antonio Valdez. Be able to bring him up.
I can tell you. See.
Okay.
Yes, here I am. I am in Mexico, and well, I would like to ask Scott Ritter and anyone else who would like to add their opinion. We have been reading reports for some time over these last 3 years, like the one from the International Security Program and other similar reports that conclude that the current pace of U.S. operation is adequate for peacetime operations, but not for major conflicts. If there were a major regional conflict, such as a war with China, the medium and long-term, long-range weapons would quickly be exhausted, and there is no capacity to increase for a major war. And we recently heard the German defense ministry speak of preparing for war in 2029. My question is, can we interpret this at least as perhaps a good news in the short term, that the president will not launch into a global conflict because the conditions are not adequate, or that could perhaps delay a possible nuclear response? Thank you.
Thanks. Well, the good, again, Air Force technology, here we go. The good news is you're correct that neither the United States nor NATO is in a position to engage in a large-scale conflict with Russia. Russia has done something in the two-plus years that the special military operation has been ongoing that I think has shocked the West. I mean, you could hear it in the words of General Christopher Cavoli. He's the commander of American forces in Europe, where he said the Russians, they got their defense industry up and running. They've rebuilt their military. They have a very large military, well-trained, well-led, well-equipped, and we got nothing like that. And we're not going to have anything like that anytime soon. The West has shown an inability to gear up for this kind of large-scale war because there's a political cost to be played. And as we saw recently in Europe with the recent European elections, there is a political price to pay for bad policy. And some European political parties have paid a heavy price. Emmanuel Macron has paid a heavy price for bad policy. And the idea of going on a war footing where you haven't adequately explained the necessity of conflict to your people is bad policy. So neither the United States nor Europe is in a position to confront Russia in a sustained, high-intensity fashion. That's the good news. The bad news is we still have a policy that's very aggressive against Russia, which means that the default in lieu of adequate conventional capacity is nuclear posture. So rather than making us safer, this actually makes the world a much more dangerous place to live because we aren't altering our policies to meet conventional realities, conventional capabilities. We are insisting on moving forward aggressively on policies that can only be backed up by nuclear weapons, which makes the likelihood of these weapons being used that much higher.
Okay, well, we're going to come back here now to the live audience, but let me simply announce that we have David Anderson with Presenza and Leonidas Christanthopoulos will be the next two people on the social media. So this individual in the front, you had your hand up.
Who's that?
Did you have a question?
Yes. Hang on. Thank you very much. Ivan Pilshik of Test News Agency. I've got a follow-up question on the issue that Colonel Black has already touched upon. So what are the chances that U.S. or its allies in one form or another will provide Ukraine with nuclear arms? Thank you so much.
I would say I don't envision the U.S. providing nuclear weapons to Ukraine unless it is as part of a scheme that allows where we would control the nuclear weapons, but it would give us some degree of plausible deniability, sort of a buffer between us and the actual employment. I think we would be careful about doing that. But, Scott, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'll just quickly say that I think there's zero chance we would ever give Ukraine nuclear weapons. One, it's insane. Why would we turn over the most dangerous weapons in the world to the most irresponsible nation in the world? You know, we have leaders in America that speak highly of Zelensky, but we know the truth. He is not a good leader. We have leaders that talk about Ukrainian democracy, but we know the truth. It's not a democracy. We know it's the most corrupt place in Europe, maybe one of the most corrupt places in the world, led by people who are totally inadequate to the task. We would never in a million years give Ukraine a nuclear weapon. And I'll just throw in another reason why. NATO has a nuclear doctrine. And we talk about how we employ nuclear weapons as part of a NATO nuclear strategy. Key to that is that it's kept within NATO and that it's done consensually. If the United States were to give nuclear weapons to Ukraine, we would be undercutting our own posture when it comes to the validity and viability of a unified NATO nuclear response. So it's counterproductive across the board. I don't see the United States ever giving Ukraine weapons, nor do I see the United States ever standing by while Ukraine seeks to acquire nuclear weapons. We will never let the irresponsible entity known as Ukraine have nuclear weapons. That's my personal belief.
Okay. Here. And then.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Monk. I'm with Patriot Action Pact, and I wanted to ask a question with regards to the election. You said that, of course, bad policies, you know, you spoke about that. We seem to have a president running for office right now that is intent on issuing bad policies. In any other election year, downplaying war would be a good voter call, but he seems to be doing the opposite. Do you think there's a possibility that nuclear conflict or an escalation of the existing conflict could be used as an election tool by this administration?
Well, you've got the wag the dog scenario. This, the idea that sort of as a last minute ploy, you go to war because wars mobilize people and excite them and all of a sudden everything is forgotten. We've seen this happen before. This is how the war against Serbia originated. It was the United States was going to stay out of the war in Serbia, and then there was an impeachment underway with President Clinton, and all of a sudden we changed our policy and went to war. It seems to me difficult to pull that off this time because people have seen sort of the unfolding of the war. Politically, I don't sense that it works. The wag the dog thing works best when there's something that's rather unexpected, where you can suddenly deploy troops and there's this sudden shock of excitement. I think people are very tired of war. They're obviously tired in Europe. They've made that clear, and they've rejected war in Europe. And I think there is this same feeling in this country. It's like it was very exciting at the beginning, and now it's become a grind. People are getting very tired of it. I think if the president were to do something very dramatic, you know, of course, they're becoming desperate in some ways, depends on how desperate, but I think it would be difficult to pull off that scenario.
Let me simply take the
opportunity.
Sure.
I want to hear what Colonel Wilkerson thinks about this, because he actually was in an administration that took the country to war for political purposes. So I think his insights into this particular question would be invaluable, if you don't mind, Colonel.
No, there's no question that George W. Bush had as a principal incentive with the war in Iraq, the one that started in 2003, doing the same thing for him that the first Iraq war did for his father. Too early. His father wasn't reelected. But Bush timed it so that he thought, no, the American people will vote for me and I'll be reelected in 2004 because I'm at war. It very much was an incentive, not the principal one, but it was an incentive. Here's where I'm worried about this conversation a very different way. I think one of the reasons Joe Biden in particular is not seeking a ceasefire and a peace agreement, or at least peace negotiations leading to an agreement, And all that that would mean is because he's like LBJ in 1965. LBJ said, quote, "Old hole ain't going to be moved by no bombs," when the Air Force briefed him on all the things they were going to do to North Vietnam and so forth. LBJ knew that we could not win that war and yet went on and escalated to over 500,000 troops. Why did he do that? He did that because he wanted the Great Society to come about. And he knew that if he were perceived as cutting and running from a war that he, in essence, had inherited but nonetheless had taken charge of, he would be punished by the American people. I think Biden's thinking the same way. He cannot cut and run from Ukraine until the election's over and he's won. That's insidious. It's just incredible. But it is true that domestic politics, often more powerful than even foreign politics, influences the president's decision-making, particularly on war. And that's how I think it's influencing Biden right now. And it's keeping him from going to the peace table. That plus the fact, as Dean Acheson said so powerfully, prestige is often more important than actual winning or losing. And prestige is involved now. It's involved for Jake Sullivan, Tony Blinken, Joe Biden, Lindsey Graham, and a whole bunch of other idiots in the Senate and the Congress in general. It's prestige that we're fighting for now. We're losing, and we know we are losing. And we know we're losing badly. And we know we should go to the peace table, get a ceasefire, go to the peace table and seek a negotiation and get the best deal we can. But we won't do it because of prestige, and we're fearful about what it would do to our prospects of being reelected.
Let me just say at this point that there are a whole lot of questions that are coming in. We want to make sure that we acknowledge this to people, and there's something important I want to say about that, which is we're not going to be able to get to them all. But the good folks at Executive Intelligence Review have authorized me to say that all questions which are written, we will certainly make available to the speakers, and perhaps at least those that are obviously most pertinent will ask that the speakers respond in writing, and we'll be able to make those available for purposes of, you know, an exchange among people. That's only said because of the following. We have 1,600 people on just on our Shiller feed, that's only one feed, right now watching live. And in addition to that, there are other people who are writing me frantically in my private text messages also about questions they want to have asked. One of them, which was triggered by the discussion on elections, was actually not one, I got five, about the European elections, which had just occurred. This was sort of what people think of that. I want to go to Helga about that because she's in Germany, and of course she's been not more than following this. But then if anyone on the panel has any comment as to whether what the idea of the questions that was being asked is, what has been the impact we've seen in the recent European elections? And do we think that that has some importance for the direction of war? So, Helga, I'm going to ask you that first, and then let's ask if any of the people on the panel have a response to that.
I think it is important because, you know, for the first time in Germany, for example, you have now two parties of the size of a parliament party who are explicitly against the war. This is not enough to stop the coalition government from pursuing the policies. It's a shame because Germany has become the laughingstock in the whole world of being completely devoid of any sovereignty, of having become the total colonial slave of the Anglosphere, disregarding the interest of the German people. So I think given the enormity of what is happening, the election result is, you know, not adequate, but it is a major step forward. Macron got smashed. You know, I think he may be out soon. He's maneuvering back and forth, which is probably not succeeding. But you have five European heads of state who have come out extremely strongly warning of the danger of nuclear war. That is very emphatically Vucic of Serbia. Naturally, Viktor Orban of Hungary, it's Capuzzi from Georgia, And it's the Bulgarian president who is very alarmed. He says the train to war has left the station already. And we should not forget Prime Minister Fico of Slovakia, who came out very, very strongly against the danger of war. And naturally, he has been the victim of an assassination attempt, which fortunately did not function. And even his speeches afterwards are basically repeating the same thing. So I would not underestimate the cohesion of the European Union. Serbia is naturally not part of it, but the cohesion of the European Union is faltering. And in my view, this is a good thing, because what do you need a European Union bureaucracy for, which does not represent the interest of its member state and the people? So I think that Europe is in a convulsion, and since there are more elections coming this year, state elections, I think the earthquake, which we start to see, you know, the AfD is now the strongest party in all the East German states. That means, you know, soon we will have a wall between East and West Germany. Now, I don't think that will happen, but the division between Germany, East and West, is absolutely incredible. So I think it's a work in process, but, you know, to just observe it is not good enough. I have maintained since a long time that we have to build the bridge to this new system which is emerging, because, you know, we really have the same interest, and Europe should work with the countries of the global south to build a new world economic order. And the United States should go back to its tradition of the American Revolution, of the founding fathers, of John Quincy Adams' foreign policy, of Lincoln, of Roosevelt, of Kennedy, and then I think all problems could be solved.
Okay. Scott?
Real quick. There's a lot of people out. We're in an election year, and I can say firsthand, and I'm sure everybody has similar stories, there's just people that don't believe their vote counts anymore. Or when they look at the candidates that are likely to be on the ballot, they just say, we don't like any of them. And this is all legitimate. But for the people that say, what power is democracy? What power is the vote? Ask Emmanuel Macron. All right? The vote matters. Your vote matters. Everybody votes matters. We're here today to talk about the dangers of nuclear war. As Colonel Wilkerson said, Joe Biden and his administration may be formulating policy that promotes the potential of nuclear conflict, because that's the only way out for Joe. He's desperate. He can't be seen as being weak. Why don't we, the people, tell Joe that it ain't weak to walk away from nuclear war? And if Joe doesn't want to listen, why don't we tell Donald Trump, you're not weak by not promoting nuclear war? Why don't we get enough Americans in the street before the election to say, we are the swing vote, the people that don't want nuclear war? And if you don't win us over, we're not voting for you, and you could lose the election. Well, you see, we live in a evenly divided nation right now. And if we can get enough people together, united the notion that America needs to be walking away from nuclear war, not sleepwalking towards nuclear war, our vote will matter. Our vote will matter. So we need to find a way to capture this. I'm not the solution, but I'll tell you this. On September 28th, we're putting together a rally in Kingston. If we can get 1 million people in the streets, shut down the thruway like we did in Woodstock, that sends a signal. And if we have similar rallies in every swing state in America, where people just got up one day, Saturday, September 28th, stood up and said, I'm angry as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. Listen to me or lose the election. They will listen. And we know this is true, because on June of 1982, 1 million people went into the streets of Central Park, New York, and they protested against nuclear war. They protested in favor of arms control. The President of the United States at that time was a crazy, red-hating man named Ronald Reagan. Evil empire. 5 years later, he signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, beginning a process, as Colonel Wilkerson said, led to blowing, getting rid of nuclear warheads, getting rid of nuclear weapons. We can do it. We, the people of the United States, government of the people, by the people, for the people, but the people have to make themselves matter. Ask Emmanuel Macron what happens when the people decide that you don't matter anymore. Ask Joe Biden, ask Donald Trump what happens when we, the people, decide they don't matter anymore. Our vote does count. Let's make it count.
Okay, what we're going to do is the following. We're going to go back to social media, and I'm going to ask that the questioners, because there's so many people, and there's some people who are now, we all have scheduling issues, I ask that people will direct their question to an individual speaker. We'll get one question and one response. If someone has something that's urgent, which one of the other speakers wishes to say, we'll put that in. I want to go to David Anderson with Presenza. Can we bring him up?
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I am David Anderson with Presenza, with the International Press Agency. And my question is concerning the international community, how people in different parts of the world, in South America, in Africa, in Asia, can contribute to fight that situation, and a little bit how the power little bit has been done before with the South African campaign against apartheid. Can something like this be done concerning the war in Ukraine?
Anybody want to take that?
I had a little trouble understanding the question.
Yeah, it's not entirely. What? Helga raised her hand, so she got it. So go ahead.
I think what I said earlier, that since global war affects the entire human community, it is emphatically the right of countries and voices from the global south, which is the global majority, you know, they represent 85% of the human population. And I think the more people, the more newspapers, social media, politicians, institutions, students, universities, think tanks, papers would call for world peace and denounce this present confrontation, the better. Because the problem is that, you know, while we are on the verge of World War III, which could happen by an accident or by miscalculation, the general population is not aware of it, because the NATO policy is so much focused on controlling of the narrative that they have, you know, launched now a whole apparatus of fact checkers, of, you know, so-called fight against disinformation. There is an entire apparatus which is out to manipulate the public opinion, to demonize Russia, to demonize China, and to basically create an image, you know, that they have, NATO has committed no fault. It's all these evil other countries. And that's not true. You saw at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, there were, I think, 139 countries, 21,000 people representing, you know, the vast majority of the world who think differently, but they are not heard in the West. So I think the more louder the voice from the global south comes, so that the people who are listening only to the very, very controlled mass media, that those people wake up and hear what the global south has to say. I think that's the most important thing which could happen right now as a new element in the situation to shift the world in a more safe direction.
Okay, I also just want to announce we're going to take another 26 minutes here through to 3 o'clock. And I see some people are now writing questions, which is very good. I was corrected. We are now up to 1,700 people who are watching simultaneously. So we want to go now to Leonidas Christanthopoulos. Maybe you want to also say who you are.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Yes, all right.
My question is to Larry Wilkerson on the issue of civil protection in the case of a nuclear attack. I had also, when I was a kid during the Cold War, I had also lived in Washington, D.C., where we were going through all these nuclear alerts in school. I remember the sirens going off in Washington. Now, nothing is happening in the United States to inform the people of what to do in case of emergency. Nothing is happening in Europe. I wrote an article about the necessity of doing something in Greece about that. And 2 days after that, Germany woke up. Somebody took that article and started saying that something must be done. The authorities here in Greece don't give a damn. They tell me that if we raise the issue, there'll be panic. I tell them that you should make modifications in the subways so that they could accommodate the population of Athens and other practical things. But I have the impression that their point of view is that after we have a nuclear attack, we don't give a damn what happens to the people. We have some holes for ourselves to save ourselves. Is this what's happening in the other Western countries and in the U.S.? I mean, the people of the West are going to be sacrificed like that. That's my question.
That's a good question, actually. I went through the experience of the enhancement, I guess that's the right term, of our continuation of government, COG, capability, immediately after 9/11, as you might expect. I even got flown away to an alternate command post, blindfolded and in full mop gear, that is to say, mass protective clothing and everything else, on the Black Hawk helicopter, and landed and sworn in as president of the United States when I got there. My first act was to fire Donald Rumsfeld. We have places all over now, largely as a result of that. And the intelligentsia, as it were, the nomenclatura, the people who make the decisions and are the political leaders in this country, will survive for a brief time anyway. If we have an all-out nuclear war, no one's going to survive, period. But it is kind of comfortable for those who are in the leadership positions to know that they have these alternative command posts and that they'll be whisked away to them and they'll be saved, at least for an interim period. And you're right, there's nothing else that I can detect across the country, certainly nothing like we had during the height of the Cold War. And that's one of the reasons, as I tried to emphasize before in my initial comments, that's one of the reasons I think the American people are ignorant. And I don't mean that in a derisive sense. I simply mean it in a descriptive sense. They don't know. They haven't a clue. And politicians have no interest whatsoever in giving them a clue.
Okay, thank you
very much.
Let me just add one quick thing, if I could. You know, I think it would make very good sense. Now, I happen to believe that there would be some survivability after a nuclear war. I think most of the Western world would be annihilated. New York City would be turned to glass. The Pentagon, Northern Virginia would be turned to glass. But I think there would be some survivability. And I think one thing that might wake people up a little bit would be notices, for example, on the New York subway, telling people to get their potassium iodide tablets, which you take them immediately after the outbreak, and you load up your thyroid with iodine so that it doesn't take in the iodine from the fallout. I think if people began to put things in a concrete way where they began to envision what it was going to be like and actually, you know, sort of like we did when we were growing up as kids, I can still remember, you covered your eyes because the flash blinded people. You put your your hand behind your back to protect your neck from the roof falling in, and you got under your little wooden desk. We did it all the time. I remember it to this day. We don't have anything like that, but I think I have potassium iodide tablets, not because I'm, you know, overly reactive. I've been in a lot of combat and so forth, but I just think that the family should be protected. So I think if we took, you know, some concrete measures and we notified people, here are protective actions you could take, you may not survive, but it's worth at least doing something. It might make people think twice. I don't know. What do you think, Scott?
Just real quick on this one. You mentioned in your outstanding remarks about a statement made by a National Security Council official talking about we're going to be aggressively pursuing a potential nuclear scenario. And that's sort of interesting because that implies that the government is doing planning for a potential nuclear conflict. Prepared to execute if the president makes the decision. That's fair. But then now we have an election season. Why doesn't somebody ask Joe Biden, if you're ordering the military to be prepared to execute a nuclear operation, what are you telling the American people? What are we prepared to execute? Where's our survivability? Are you abandoning us? And the answer is yes. So once again, to reiterate everything that we've been trying to say here to the people of the United States, be afraid. Be very afraid. They are planning a nuclear war, and your survivability does not factor into it one thing. The only choice you have right now is to turn yourself into a weapon of democracy. Make your voice count. And there's no more important issue today than stopping the nuclear war that our government is planning, and they're leaving you out of it. Because if they cared about you, they'd be handing out the pills. They'd be talking about nuclear drills. They'd be reopening the subways and the gymnasium basements and everything else. They'd be stockpiling water, stockpiling food. But they're not doing that because you don't matter. Make yourselves matter.
We're going to try one thing. We'll make one exception on the internet. If Dimitri Lascaris is still there, I understand he had his hand up from the beginning, and we may have missed him. Don't know if he's still available. I believe he had to. He's an independent journalist that was going to be going to do an interview. So if he is able to be brought up, let's bring him up right now. And if not, we'll continue. I was passed one note that you may be or may not be aware of, Scott and others. The administration, Biden administration, just announced that the United States will provide arms and training to the Azov Brigade.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that we may want to comment about a little bit because I think some people were aware of it, but others were not. Let's come back here now to the floor. Okay, in the back.
I'm Aleem Muhammad, and a question for Scott Ritter. You were pulled off of a plane. You were on your way to St. Petersburg to attend the International Economic Forum. What were you going to say? They got everybody so upset.
It's no secret what I was going to say. The passport that was taken from me and revoked by the State Department, there's been no explanation provided as to why they did this and on what authority they did this. But they did it. It's a passport that was issued to me in 2021. It was a valid passport. It's a passport that I've used to travel internationally several times, to include two prior trips to Russia. It's a passport that the U.S. government is intimately familiar with because they seize it from me every time I return from Russia, as they hold me in a pen awaiting detailed questioning about what I was about to do or what I had done in Russia. What I've been doing since May of 2023 is traveling to Russia on a mission of peace, a mission designed to learn about the Russian people, to learn about their culture, to learn about their history, to learn about their soul. and to capture this and bring it back to America as the antidote to the disease, the poison of Russophobia that has gripped the American people. Maybe they weren't afraid in May because it was the initial go-around. I know that I was very well received in Russia, but it didn't resonate so much in the United States. But I went back in December and January, December of last year, January of this year, again on an extended trip. This one took me to the new territories, took me to Crimea, took me to Chechnya, of all places. Anybody who speaks Russian, please don't watch my speech to these Chechen soldiers because it's the worst Russian language performance in modern history. But the point is, I was starting to gain traction. My message was starting to resonate not only inside Russia, but here in the United States and around the world. The trip that I was going on started at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, but it didn't stop there. There was going to be a 40-day journey throughout Russia from the Pacific Ocean to the Baltic Sea and everything in between, where I would take this message of speaking to the Russians, of peace, of hope, of trying to find an alternative to the policy paths that we're currently on that lead to the potential of nuclear war. 40 days, and we had set up the mechanism where we would be live streaming this event back to an American audience that is growing exponentially as we speak. This scared, excuse my French, the crap out of the Biden administration. Scared them to death, which is why they took the extraordinary measure of pulling me out of the line and preventing me from flying. A violation of my Fifth Amendment rights of freedom of travel, a violation of my First Amendment rights against illegal search and seizure. They have provided no reason why they did this. And ultimately, because they knew what I was doing and they knew what they were stopping by stopping me, a violation of my First Amendment rights. I know my Constitution. Apparently, the Biden administration doesn't.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions here? There are... Okay, right here.
Carl Osgood with EIR. I was happy that Colonel Wilkerson mentioned Daniel Ellsberg, because another thing that Daniel Ellsberg said, and I read this in his book, never had the pleasure of meeting him in person, was that he said, contrary to popular myth, the popular view, the U.S. has always used nuclear weapons in the way that a criminal uses a gun in order to get what he wants, even if he doesn't pull the trigger. So my question for both Scott Ritter and Colonel Wilkerson is, how is the U.S. using nuclear weapons now?
Again, Colonel, I yield to you.
Is he muted? I think we're not getting an audio.
I'd say, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I'd say it's been some time since I was in government and associated with nuclear weapons in any direct way. But I would surmise that we are using them the way we have used them throughout the time of our possession of them, including having them first, as the film Oppenheimer made sort of a graphic presentation of. And Lindsey Graham has given new resonance to with his allusion of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with respect to Gaza. Lindsey has reached new crescendos of insanity, in my view, and I'm from the same state he is, South Carolina. We use nuclear weapons as a backdrop for threatening whenever we need to use them. We talked about earlier the situation in the global south. Well, let's just look at what's happening with the rest of the world, is what I like to call it. Right now, according to the Office of Financial Assets Control, we have probably somewhere between 30 and 35 countries under draconian sanctions. We have a lot of individuals in addition to the countries under draconian sanctions. We are detested by 3.6 billion people in the world, is my guess, given the countries under sanction, given their nature, and given, in many cases, the absolute lack of any real reason to have them and the fact that they might be pointed at the leadership of a state or a country, but they in fact are impacting the people more than the leadership, if the leadership at all. And so we have built up a body of people in the world that I estimate to be somewhere between a quarter and a third that hate our guts. Well, behind all of that, of course, is nuclear weapons. And we talked about this earlier, and Scott alluded to it. I'm a member of something called the All-Volunteer Force Forum. As a matter of fact, I and General Dennis Leitch founded it several years ago. And one of the things we have been doing is taking a good hard look at the American military today. And what Scott said, I can amplify 1,000 times over. We are so broken within the American military that we couldn't mobilize for war if we tried. Not only that, in the polling that we do, very sophisticated polling every year and have done for almost three decades, the propensity to serve of American youth in the draft age quadrant, roughly 18 to 24, is down to 9%, the lowest it's ever been. It's General H's and my conclusion that if we had a real war, most American youth would go to Canada or Mexico in the first 48 hours. So it would be impossible to mobilize this country. Well, what do we do when we realize this? We threaten with nuclear weapons. We leave the nuclear weapons in the background. We hold the nuclear weapons up. We let people know. We don't have to tell too many. They know it. That's what scares me more than anything else about the bellicosity coming out of the White House with regard to China, with regard to Russia, with regard to Iran, because we can't back it up. We cannot back it up except with nuclear weapons. So you ask me the pregnant question, who will be the first in the world to use nuclear weapons? The same people who were the first in the world to use them in 1945. That is another thing Dan and I talked about, and we both agreed it is probably one of the most dangerous aspects of the current situation.
Okay, we're going to take one final question, which is from the Gray Zone, and I think it's online. If it's online, or is it here? Anastasia, are we online on that one?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So let him go ahead and just announce who it is and what his question is.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, this is Hekmat Abu Khater from the Gray Zone, and I sent two questions, but I'll just go for the first one. What are the implications of Biden's potential deal with the authoritarian monarchy of Saudi Arabia, in which he is offering U.S. support to develop Saudi civilian nuclear program with uranium enrichment in exchange for Saudi normalization with Israel?
Who wants to take it? Anyone?
I'll give you a first impression, and it's more than a first impression because I was there when we were talking about this in 04 and 05. What we are is desperate. We're desperate to get the situation in Gaza under some kind of control. And the only way we do that with the Arab states led by Riyadh is to guarantee this time, guarantee that there will be a Palestinian state. And that means you've got to show some concrete on the ground. There's got to be a prospect of a state. The other thing the Saudis are holding over our head is they want a nuclear weapon, or they want a latent capacity for a nuclear weapon so that when Iran gets one and they have enough uranium right now enriched, this is IAEA projection, to make a bomb, to make three bombs, as a matter of fact. So they're very close. Saudis want to be able to make one at the moment that the Iranians do. And so that's what they want this for. And we are stupid enough and desperate enough with regard to Gaza to give it to them. Now, who won't give it to them? The bad people in the world, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. They will not give the Saudis nuclear weapon capability, but we will.
Okay. Yeah, I tend to agree with Colonel Wilkerson. Everything revolves around November, the elections in November. It is absolutely vital that we keep the Ukraine war going through November. And also, the Democratic Party right now is faced with an enormous, intractable dilemma because two voting blocks of their own party are at war with one another. And the only way that they can defuse it is if they can, at this point, if they can slow down or stop the war in Gaza. It's become enormously unpopular. It has brought to light a lot of things about the history of Israel and so forth that they would prefer just stay in the past and that people not become aware of. But it is very possible that the war in Gaza may be the deciding issue in who wins the election in November. So it's very critical. We never would have thought of giving this nuclear assistance to Saudi Arabia, but at this point, they've got the leverage. We don't have the leverage. Biden must take steps to defuse this situation, and he's willing to do anything to do it. So it's, again, it's another situation where the use of nuclear weapons, or at least technology to create nuclear weapons, is on the table. And, it, of course, we're the ones who suffer the cost for this.
Okay, we're going to take one final question, which is from the Philippines, and then we're going to have summaries. Let me also indicate to people who I think will probably be more than interested after this discussion that there is an organization called the International Peace Coalition. The person who convenes that each week is Anastasia Battle, who's here to my left, and she will, I'm going to have her say something about that at the very conclusion. I think there are 1,700 people still with us. All of you are invited, if you are people of goodwill, which we presume many of you to be, to seek us out and become part of that action. So we'll go to the final question, which I mentioned is from Philippines, and it is from Maria Catherine Suba from Radio Mindanao Network, Minondo Network.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. It's already 2:57 a.m. here in the Philippines. I am Maria Catherine Suba, a freelance broadcaster. I am a co-host of late Butch Valdez with Itas Valdez in Radio Mindanao Network, BZXL, ang ating katipunan show. My question goes to Mr. Scott Ritter. As a former UN weapons inspector and U.S. Marine intelligence officer, and actually to anyone else who wants to answer, a proxy war is being orchestrated in this part of the world, our country, the Philippines. Our country is actually being used by the U.S. in its intent of war against China. And according to geopolitical analysts, the Philippines will be the next Ukraine. The Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has allowed additional 9 EDCA sites, or more appropriately, 9 U.S. military bases all over the country. The armed forces of the Philippines seem to be following orders from their U.S. counterpart. Drumbeats of war is being heard almost every day. Xenophobia is being propagated on mainstream media. Almost every week, there is an incident of Chinese Coast Guard that water cannons a Philippine vessel at the South China Sea. Do you think a false flag operation can happen here as tensions are getting worse? What do you propose for this to stop? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the question. Just so you know, I have a little bit of background in the Philippines. In 1986, I was deployed there as a platoon commander to reinforce the Subic garrison after the fall of the Marcos regime. There was concern about the New People's Army. So I have a warm spot in my heart for the Philippines. Let's build upon what Colonel Wilkerson had said earlier. The United States is incapable of fighting a sustained conflict against a peer-level force. The United States cannot fight and engage China and win. We will not beat the Chinese. We cannot beat the Chinese, and we know this, and yet we're using the Philippines to create the conditions of potential conflict with the Chinese. Please understand that for the Filipino people, this is a recipe for disaster. You think America is your friend. So too did the Ukrainian people, and they are dying
by the hundreds of thousands. Friends don't let friends die in those quantities. The Ukrainians have been displaced by the tens of millions. Friends don't let friends have their cities destroyed in this manner. Friends don't let friends have families separated, have mothers and children destined to a life of refugee status in perpetual poverty. That's not how friends behave. America has never been the friend of the Ukrainians, and we are not the friends of the Filipinos. We don't like you. If we did like you, we wouldn't be doing this to you. We are using you. You are a tool, nothing but a tool. And when the tool ceases to be useful, we will discard you. And discard you means usually after a war that devastates you. We are using you to gain some sort of momentary leverage over the Chinese. We will fail. The Chinese will win, and you will be destroyed. End of story. It's high time the Filipino people pressure their government to start sitting down and engaging the Chinese government responsibly. China is not your enemy. China is your neighbor. China is your friend. China doesn't want war. And if you would engage China in diplomacy, and as we've all indicated here, America has long since lost the skill set necessary to carry out diplomacy, but the Filipinos, the Philippine people, can reignite this, to relearn it, to use this skill to prevent a war. But if you continue to behave as colonial subjects, and I know that's a sore subject in the Filipinos, because you were the colonial subjects of America. We still view you as our colonial subjects. We don't like you. We don't care about you. We just want to use you. Grow up. Grow up and act responsibly. Take control of your own future. America is not here to help you. America is here only to use you until there's nothing left, and then we will discard you on the trash heap of history.
I must tell you, I spent a lot of time in the Philippines and came in off the carrier Iwo Jima, the Valley Forge, the Guadalcanal, and both Scott would agree with me. Americans have a tremendous love for the Filipino people. I would say two of my very, very closest friends are from the Philippines. And we really wish very much that you were not in this posture. But I think it's very important for the Philippines to be clear-eyed in what's going on and not to be led down the path by bellicose military people from the United States. You're talking about small islands. I wish China were not engaged in that particular policy. I tend to be sympathetic towards them on many things, but less so on that one. But at the same time, I think you've got to make sort of a cold, clear-eyed assessment and say, look, it's not worth a war with a great power for the Philippines to engage in combat over those small islands. But I do agree that it is time to use diplomacy and to attempt to resolve the issue. Whatever you do, do not simply become a tool of the United States and be led into an armed conflict that ends up in disaster for the Filipino people. Because if you do, you will break the heart of a whole lot of us who just dearly love the Philippines and the people of the islands.
Okay, so we're at the point of summary remarks. I want to start with Larry Wilkerson. And, of course, if there's anything you wish to address that hasn't been addressed already, please feel free to do so. And we'll then proceed. Go ahead.
I'll just add to what was just said. I thought when Teddy Allen brought Ferdinand Marcos and Imelda Marcos to Pearl and we escorted them up to Camp Smith, that the Philippines had finally awakened and thrown us out and that we would never be back. And then I saw Donald Rumsfeld take advantage of 9/11 and start infiltrating special forces back into the Philippines. And I knew the game was back on again. So I agree with what both Scott and Colonel Black said. There's a lot of affection on my part for the Philippines, too. But you should grow up and not need the United States and not put the United States and China at loggerheads over your dead body, because that's what it will be about. The topic here today was nuclear weapons. And I'll just say this again. The most likely state owning nuclear weapons today to use those nuclear weapons again is the United States. And we have put ourselves in that position and in that posture by our incompetence at the other skill sets, most prominently diplomacy, necessary for the relations of nations. We are not a very competent in any vein of diplomacy entity anymore. There's an old principle of the relations of nations called conservation of enemies. Simply stated, it says that a prudent state never has any more enemies at any one time than it can handle. We have 3.6 billion and growing every day, probably by 100 million a week, people who hate our guts, who detest us, who are fed up with us, who think the rules-based order is our rules and orders to them. That's not going to last. It's not going to preserve us. It's not going to preserve our empire in any way, fashion, or form. So if we don't change very quickly, we're going down. And what I would advise people like the Philippines and Australia and other of our good allies over this last 50, 60, 70 years is to check your six really closely and see what you can do to make accommodations with the other powers in the world, most prominently Russia and China. But India is big time in there, too. India will be a replacement for China if she just keeps her act together for the next 20 years. And then we'll have those two countries at loggerheads. But you're looking at a dying empire. You're looking at a dying empire. And if we don't do something about it, we're going to have a really bad death rather than a death, say, like Britain had, where she is still around, stupidly led by Rishi Sunak, but soon to be gotten rid of, probably. So it's a different world. It's a totally different world. It's no longer unipolar. It's multipolar. And it's going to act that way. It's going to have a new financial system, a new monetary exchange system, a new banking system. Everything's going to be new. And we're going to be on the outside unless we learn to accommodate. And you learn to accommodate with that deft instrument of national power called diplomacy. So we'd rather grow some diplomats and fast.
Okay. Thank you. Colonel Black.
Yeah, I would just like to add one thing. You know, in 1991, the Soviet Empire simply dissolved. It was one of the great victories of mankind that we had been engaged in this tense standoff, and it ended bloodlessly. At that point, we had a 1,000-mile buffer between Germany and the Russian border. And it was an opportunity, a historic opportunity, to draw back from this nuclear brinksmanship where we were just literally toe-to-toe at the wall between East and West. But we failed to take advantage of it, and under various presidents, George Bush was one of them, and just sort of the whole sequence of fellows, we moved the border. We kept moving eastward until finally we reached the point where now we are virtually up to the Russian border. This whole thing, you know, when the wall fell, the Warsaw Pact dissolved. It just simply disappeared, but NATO didn't. And I can recall, as a senior officer at the time, thinking, just hold a parade and tell them we've won, go home. But we didn't. We kept it alive. In order for NATO to survive the collapse of the Soviet Union, We had to create an illusion. We had to have an enemy. Russia was not an enemy. Russia was desperate to integrate with the rest of Europe and to become part of all Western civilization. And it just was a terrible loss for humanity that we gave up that buffer, we gave up the opportunity to integrate Russia, and now we have perpetuated this illusion of them as this threatening enemy, which they are not.
Scott?
First of all, I want to thank you, Dennis, and I want to thank Helga. I want to thank Colonel Werkelson, Colonel Black, and everybody who is attending in person and online for coming. And this is one of the most important topics that can be discussed in the world today. And so the fact that you're listening implies that you understand this. Now the question is, what do we do about this? How do we go forth from here? How do we take this message out and turn it into something discernible, something that can prevent the wars that we acknowledge should never be fought, nuclear conflict? I was advised, and I'm one of these stupid Marines that gets lots of advice and then I ignore it. I was advised to do not try to scare people. No. You all need to be scared, every single one of you. You need to have the kind of fear. You know, there's people who live in the Southwest who've been told over and over again about the danger of wildfires. That'll happen to them, not me. Until they're in their car with their dogs, with no escape route, the flames have closed in, and they're feeling the heat. And at that moment, they get that ugly feeling in the pit of the stomach. And they get the cold sweat, and they know they're going to die. They know they're going to die because it's there in front of them. It's unavoidable. That fear every American needs to feel. The same fear people have who live in hurricane zones. You say, well, don't worry about it. Hurricanes happen to other people by me. But then the water's coming in. It's swept away everything you're holding on for dear life. And suddenly that feeling in your stomach, I'm going to die. Every American needs to wake up every morning with that fear in your stomach because you're going to die. It's a certainty unless we change the policy direction that we're on. I don't know what you think anybody's been saying up here, but what I heard is we're headed towards a nuclear conflict that the United States is going to start. How do we stop it? The first thing is realization that this threat is real. You need to be afraid. You need to be very afraid. And then and only then will you take the action necessary to stop this. And we know what the action is. Ask Emmanuel Macron. Go to the voting booth in November, if we're still alive, and make sure that your vote counts. But in order for it to count, the people running for office have to know what your vote stands for. And you need to come together collectively, and we need to tell them that there is a consensus that we don't want to die in a nuclear Armageddon. And that if you are a politician running for national office and you don't oppose nuclear war, you will never get our vote, regardless of party, regardless of personality, regardless of anything. We must empower ourselves by making this issue the dominant issue, and they have to wake up for it. So I'll just leave you with September 28th, ladies and gentlemen. Let's make that day, that Saturday in September, the day that the American people put the nuclear issue on the table, on the ballot, and tell our elected officials or those who want to become elected officials that they won't be elected unless they can convince us that they don't want a nuclear war and they will enact policies to avoid nuclear conflict. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Helga.
Well, first of all, let me thank all the speakers for the very important warning you are giving to the world, and also the participants who are listening online or in other forms in sitting in the room. But I would like to invite you to get active immediately, not just wait for the U.S. election, because, you know, and I want you to join the International Peace Coalition. The next meeting is Friday, 5 o'clock European time, 11 o'clock U.S. time. the reason why this is so urgent is because we are going, in my view, in the most important and dangerous period probably in all of history. The reasons for this is the following. We have a beginning of July, the NATO annual summit. And I think given the fact that the Ukrainian war is really running into trouble, and but for the new weapon systems, it would have ended already, because it's you know, the people are not there, the soldiers are not there. And, you know, this will be an incredible moment, because NATO has an immense reputation problem, an image loss in the eyes of the world. NATO already lost shamefully against 65,000 Taliban fighters in Afghanistan and left Kabul in August 21. You all remember the images of people hanging onto the airplanes trying to get out. They were abandoned, by the way, you know, by the NATO, the so-called locals who had worked with NATO for 20 years were left behind. That should be a lesson also for the Philippines and the Ukrainians. And now the war in the Ukraine is lost by NATO. I mean, what does it mean if the entire force of NATO, with all the weapons and all the incredible monies which were spent, were not able to defeat the Russian army, which has a military budget which is about 10% of that of the United States, an image loss which is incredible, and that increases for the time being the danger, you know, that a nuclear escalation could happen out of this dynamic. Then we have another problem. We have the idiotic policy that some people, Janet Yellen, the EU, they want to confiscate the Russian assets, which they confiscated already, but to spend them for Ukraine. Now, even the IMF has warned that they should not do that, because that would put at risk the entire financial system, because Russia already has announced that they will retaliate and confiscate US and European assets, and that could trigger a whole chain reaction of such developments, because that will be read by the Global South as one more reason to de-dollarize, because it's not safe to be in the dollar. Then you have the BRICS summit in October. That will be, in all likelihood, a very spectacular event where many, many more countries, up to now there were 59 countries who announced that they want to be part of this new system. That will be also, you know, a point where the West has to really reflect what to do, and then naturally comes the November election. Now, I think we need to think not only of mobilizing in this entire period between now and the US election, because I think this is an extremely dangerous period, but also because if we do not introduce another component into our thinking, a new way of, you know, approaching the whole idea of humanity, of are we the creative species or not? And I would like you to remember what happened actually in 1945 when Germany was completely a rubble field. You remember the pictures of Dresden after the bombardment. Many other cities were looking almost like that. And at that point, you know, and that is, by the way, one of the reasons, responding to the earlier questions, would the Western leaders today not do what they do if they would understand nuclear war? I think the problem is a generational and a cultural problem, because I remember very well in Europe, the World War II generations, they knew what war was. And they, you know, they told our generation, you know, we didn't experience it, but I have all the stories told by my grandparents, by my parents and relatives, you know, about the horrors of war. And that is sort of in my genes. And, you know, the new generation, which is completely shallow-minded, and they don't know history, they don't know culture, they don't know what the classics is. So they are being brainwashed by all of these manipulations, and they just don't get it. And I think, you know, the older people and the younger people have to get together. Now, what happened in 45 was that the shock about how could Germany, this beautiful pearl in the nations of countries, which it was during the time of Bach, of Mozart, Beethoven, of Schiller, of Goethe. You know, how could such a nation, which had produced so many inventors and so many creative individuals, sink so deep to the level of Nazism and the 12 years of the horror show of what Nazism meant? Well, I think people were so shocked that there was a soul searching, and people said, we have to give ourselves a higher lawfulness, that this can never happen again. And there was a big debate about natural law, that we have to have something which is more fundamental than positive law or whatever people do and say. And that this natural law in European history was the idea that there is a higher lawfulness which is built in creation, which we have to access and which is valid and which is functioning in the real world. Now, unfortunately, that debate about the use of natural law as a very practical aspect in legislation, in lawfulness, was abandoned. It was abandoned by the occupying powers. It was vanished by the Frankfurt School. It was eliminated by the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which started the re-education to eliminate any such profound ideas. And that is part of the tragedy, why people don't remember this period, which was a very important moment of recollection. How could this tragedy have happened? And that is why in the new security and development architecture, which I have proposed, the last three principles refer to these epistemological foundations on which the new paradigm has to be built. So I would urge you to look at that, study it, and let us bring this into the debate, because I think we need this higher lawfulness. In Europe, it was called natural law. In India, it is called cosmology. In China, it was called the mandate of the heaven. And, you know, in every great culture and nation, you had this idea that there is such a higher lawfulness on which we have to agree because we are human beings. And I think that has to be part of the discussion, because we have to uplift humanity very, very rapidly to a higher level of morality if we want to survive this great danger.
Thank you, Helga. Anastasia Battle, who is the convener of the International Peace Coalition, will make an announcement, and then we will conclude.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Scott Ritter and Colonel Richard Black. Helga and myself, we co-founded the International Peace Coalition with the idea of bringing people together of above their ideologies across the world from many different countries to say, we must have peace now. How many times have you seen the peace movement be completely destroyed and divided from gossip, you know, just complete nonsense? We have to bring people together now to say, no nuclear war. We must bring humanity to a higher level now. And I'm very honored that we've had both Scott Ritter and Colonel Richard Black on the International Peace Coalition. I want to invite you here in the audience, but also the people who are online, which I can only imagine is thousands at this point. You can email in to questions@schillerinstitute.org, and we'd be happy to get back to you and bring you into the fold. We need as many people on board right now, as you can hear from our veteran heroic warriors for peace, that they're not going to stop, and we need to have that same courage within all of you. So thank you so much for joining us in this process, and we look forward to your collaboration.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Richard Black, Scott Ritter, Helga Zepp-LaRouche, we want to thank you for being here and joining us, and I want all of you here to join me in thanking them for what they've done today.